you first met John Hancock in 1985, and he was already 81 years old at that time, what struck you most about him?
His dignity. He carried himself with tremendous dignity, and everybody was impressed when they first met him. First of all, people thought he was dead. People didn't know he was alive. Pete Seeger kind of rediscovered him, along with a guy named Joe Glazer, and brought him to this Labor Heritage Festival. And so we all met him at the same time, a big room of labor singers at the George Meany Center in Silver Spring, Maryland. And John very humbly got up and talked to people and introduced himself and immediately launched into Gonna Roll the Union On, which is his best-known song. And everybody joined in, and it broke the ice. And after that, he was like, everybody just loved this guy.
So people, he had written that song and everyone knew it and had come to be so well-known?
Yeah, he wrote that song in 1936 or 37, 36 actually, and it kind of knocked around the labor movement in the 30s and 40s. Eventually, people think Solidarity Forever, Gonna Roll the Union On, and We Shall Not Be Moved are sort of like some of the best-known songs in the labor movement, and so one of them is his.
Now, you call your book The Sharecropper's Troubadour, but he didn't grow up in a sharecropping family. Tell me about his early years.
His history is quite interesting, and I didn't know this when I started. It came through a lot of research, trying census records and things like that. He was born in 1904 in Brinkley, Arkansas, and I say it was the worst time and the worst place to be black in America. It was at the height of segregation. Arkansas was a very violent state. It was kind of still a frontier. A lot of hangings, lynchings, burnings, mob attacks. And he grew up in a family of people who owned some land and rented some land. And this was a common thing at that time. And at that time in Arkansas, a lot of people had access to land because it was sort of a frontier. It was settled much later than other parts of the South. And then it, over time, became really a place of plantations where big ownership of land became the dominant thing. It started squeezing out all these other people. So by the time the 1920s came, when he was a young man, his father was having difficulty maintaining an independent income. And then his father was killed in an accident when a team of mules took off with the carriage and threw him from the carriage, and he hit a tree and broke his neck. And John was there with him and watched him die. And they had 11 children in the family, so he had a lot of brothers and sisters. And he sort of took over the family, but the problem became there were more mouths to feed than there was land, you know. So he said it. Over time, it became a problem of too many people and not enough income. So then they started sharecropping, which means somebody else owns the land. And somehow in there, they lost whatever land his grandfather owned. We don't know why or how that happened. And they moved deeper into the Mississippi Delta near the Mississippi and St. Francis Rivers, where the land was much more fertile, but the land was owned by somebody else, so big plantation holders. And so he still tried to maintain his own independence by renting land, and he didn't own any land, but he partly sharecropped, partly rented. But then things went from bad to worse. The Mississippi River flood, a huge flood in 1927, and again 1928. Cotton prices kept dropping. The Great Depression hit in 1929. So by the early 30s, all he could do was sharecrop, which is you go to work for somebody else, you live on the land, they advance some food and some fertilizer and some seeds at exorbitant interest rates. And at the end of the year, it turns out you're more in debt than when you started because the interest rates are so high. So you work all year long, and at the end of the year, instead of them paying you, you pay them. And this was what happened to sharecroppers all over the South. And about during the 1930s, about 900,000 of them left sharecropping because it turned into such a bad situation.
He had some education, though, and he could do math, so he was at an advantage over a lot of the other sharecroppers, right?
Right. One of the things about John was that he learned how to read and write and do math much more proficiently than most people, partly because he wasn't in the school system a lot. He grew up, he was very sick. A lot of kids were sick in the Delta, tuberculosis and pellagra, malnutrition, cholera, all kinds of diseases. So he learned basically from his mother and from church. He learned a lot of music from church. And his father brought home a book by Paul Laurence Dunbar, the black poet. And so he learned poetry that way. So what he told me was that when he went back to school, he knew more than the teacher did. It was mostly self-taught. And he became what he called a rhyming fool, you know, that anything that struck his eye or struck his fancy, he would make a rhyme. And so he started doing that in this one-room schoolhouse. He, quote, graduated from ninth grade, which was much, he went much further than most people did. There was no black high school, so that was as far as you could go where he lived in the country. And so he was decently literate. If you read his letters and his poems and things, it's all misspelled, and there's not correct punctuation, but he's putting words together, and a lot of the poems he wrote are just brilliant. They explain sharecropping in a way nobody else could, except somebody who lived through it.
Why don't you read one of them?
So in 1936, there was a strike of the sharecroppers in Arkansas, and they organized a thing called the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. John didn't know anything about it at the beginning of the strike, but he heard about it. And during that same year, he decided to quit sharecropping. He just quit. And he started catching fish and selling fish for a living, going door to door in the plantation districts. So he'd get into a plantation in order to sell fish, and the plantation owner would say, fine, come on in, you know. But as he was going door to door, he'd recruit people for the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. So he became a secret organizer of the union. And in March of 1936, he went to the union office with this poem, and they published it in the Sharecropper's Voice under the surname of John Henry, you know, the steel-driving man, the famous person from John Henry was a steel-driving man from that song. So John says, the planter lives off the sweat of the sharecropper's brow. How the sharecropper lives, the planter cares not how. Sharecropper raises all the planter can eat, then gets trampled underneath his feet. Sharecropper raises all the planter can wear, he and his family have to go bare. Sharecropper works, toils, and sweats. Planter brings him out in debt. Planter has good and wholesome food to eat. Sharecropper has cornbread, molasses, fatback meat. A lot of good things the planter has to waste. Sharecropper knows not how it might taste. Sharecropper's wife goes to the kitchen washtub and field. Planter's wife enjoys fancy automobile. Planter's children dresses fine and goes to school. Sharecropper's puts on rags and follows the mule. If they ask the planter for your right, you might as well spit in his face and ask for a fight. Planter says he inherit his wealth from birth, but it all comes from the poor man who tills the earth. That's only half the poem. The poem just brilliantly describes.
Sorry, I talked over you.
Yeah, and it brilliantly describes in detail, as you can hear there. It keeps going the conditions that people were in, and what he told me was that the reason he started doing this was that people, even in the worst of conditions, people become sort of used to it, and they think that's just the way the world is, and particularly where he lived, you know, there were no radio stations, no TV didn't exist, of course, no newspapers. People were really isolated, and basically what they had was the church and sort of community networks. Most kids got 2 or 3 months of school per year if they were lucky, because they were always out either planting or hoeing or harvesting cotton. And so it just became a way of life that, it's not that people accepted it, but they didn't know what to do about it. So he said the first thing is you have to recognize your situation, and you have to get mad, and you have to do something. And until people recognize that, you can't get them to move. And secondly, fear, that the last time people tried to organize a union in this area, in 1919, there was a real huge racial massacre in Elaine, Arkansas, which was 50 miles away from where this was happening. So then he started the songs, because the songs were an effort to get people to sing together and do something together.
Why was that? Why did he settle on that? Like, why was that so powerful for the union?
He said that you can say more in a song than you can in a speech, that you can get away with more in a song than you can in a speech. One of the first songs he sang to me was Everybody Talking About Heaven Ain't Going to Heaven. And it was an old slave song. It was people would sing it in these church meetings out in the plantation districts. It was a critique of the master class, but they could sing it and nobody paid any attention. So he started writing songs with this similar thing, except that he was open about what he was saying. He was very clear about what he was saying. Poem I just read is an example of that. But gonna roll, gonna roll, gonna roll the union on. If the planter's in the way, we're gonna roll it over him, roll it over him, roll it over him. It's a real fighting song. He's not kidding around. If the planters heard him saying that, you know, he'd be run out of town. But in a mass meeting, what he could do with that song is get blacks and whites together, singing together. And they had a common religious background, Protestant for the most part. They were segregated completely, blacks and whites, lived particularly on the plantations. But you could get them together in a meeting, and they knew a lot of the same tunes from old church songs. And so a lot of his songs are from tunes, from church songs. And Woody Guthrie did the same thing. A lot of people did this.
Yeah, it seems like he took those and then adapted them and made them, like you said, more kind of rallying cries, like Oh Freedom. Can you tell me about the message of that one?
Yeah, Oh Freedom was originally sung by slaves. We're not sure when it originated, but it might have been during the Civil War when emancipation was about to happen. And the closing lyric to that was, and before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. And when I was growing up in the civil rights movement in the 60s, people sang it just that way. But John changed it, and his way of saying it was, and before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and take my place with those who loved and fought before. Which is really interesting that he made that change. And, of course, he was talking about the freedom struggle of his ancestors. His grandfather had told him a lot about what slavery was like. And it was terrible, of course. If anybody watches 12 Years a Slave, you get the idea of what this was like. So he was referring to that. But also, John was a socialist. This is sort of hard for us to comprehend maybe these days, but in the 1930s in Arkansas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, a lot of the Deep South, Texas, there was large numbers of socialists, and it went back to Eugene Debs in the 1910s and 1920s, even though it was a very conservative era, the Socialist Party continued. And the Socialist Party helped organize the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. So when he said, take my place with those who loved and fought before, he was thinking about other people, black and white, who had tried to organize.
That's one thing that really struck me about his story and that I was surprised by is how integrated the Southern Tenant Farmers Union was. I didn't really expect to hear about that from the 1930s in Arkansas.
Yeah, and people paid a high price for it. They would be attacked very often by not only the police, but vigilante groups that the plantation owners would organize. In marches, they'd be shot at, beaten with clubs, axe handles, crowbars, whips. Bodies were found floating in the river.
Both white and black?
Most of the people, I don't know if I know of any white person who was killed, and I know of three or four people that I could name who were killed who were black. But a lot of white people were beaten within an inch of their lives. There was a man named Frank Reese who was maimed so badly that he mentally he never recovered. He died early as a result of the beating. And there are many other instances, really terrible, brutal beatings.
It was so dangerous for them to organize. And then at one point, John Hancock's actually had to flee Arkansas. Can you tell me what happened?
John was out in the river fishing. You know, this became his way of making money. He's out there fishing, and he heard his mother off on the shore saying, "John, John, come back, John." So he thought something had happened to one of his children. So he rushed back to the shore in his boat, and she said, "John, they're coming to kill you." A white friend of ours was up at the grocery store, and he heard them talking that they were getting up a lynch mob to come get you. And this was interesting, too, that, you know, white folks thought that all white folks would support lynching, but not so. And so this friend of theirs came down to warn him. And John said, "Well, first person that comes here to do that, I'm going to get my shotgun and, you know, I'm going to shoot him." And his mother said, "John, don't do that. If you do that, there won't be any Hancockses left. They'll kill all of us." So he realized that that was a bad idea. So he went to a friend's house that very night, and next morning he caught a Greyhound bus to Memphis, and he never went back to Arkansas after that.
Did his family follow him?
His family was sort of stuck there for about 2 years, and so he had brothers and sisters. It was an extended family, but then reprisals started coming down on them. So his brother, for example, was arrested by the local police and put on a county work farm, which is a horrible thing to have happen to you, for about 6 months. And so John was gone. His brother was gone. His wife was living on some rented land at that point, but then they lost that, so she had to move in with somebody else. Eventually, they all left. They all went to Oklahoma. And then eventually, John started traveling the country, singing and speaking on behalf of the Union. Pete Seeger's father recorded him in 1937 at the Library of Congress, and those recordings you have are from that time, 1937. But he realized he couldn't make a living, and he couldn't go back to Arkansas, so he migrated to San Diego, California. And he said the best day of his life was when he ended up in San Diego, because the weather was nice, and he found ways to make a living, basically. Building houses, renting them to people who were migrants from the South, just like himself. He said, "More people than followed the Pharaoh came behind me to San Diego." And so he just, he made a grocery store, he rented rooms, he sold watermelon off a truck, anything he could think of. Sold fish, he continued to sell fish. And then he worked as a carpenter for a while and ran into a lot of racism there in San Diego as well. For a time, they wouldn't pay him the same wage as a white worker in the Carpenters Union, which made him very mad. Also, he discovered segregation in San Diego, and he set up picket lines outside of theaters and other workplaces where they wouldn't hire blacks or let blacks in. There's a small black community in San Diego that was evolving at that time and still there. And they formed their own churches and civil rights organizations. And so he kept active. But as far as people who had heard about his songs from these recordings in 1937, and those songs were published around the country in the labor movement, Pete Seeger popularized a lot of those songs from John Hancock's, and Woody Guthrie did also. As far as everybody was concerned, John had must have died or something. Nobody knew where he went. So 50 years later, he returned, and I say in the book, when he came to Washington, D.C. for this event, where I then interviewed him and started this oral history with him, I call it John Henry's return, because he came back singing, you know, just like John Henry, the steel-driving man. You couldn't get rid of him. You couldn't put him down. You couldn't discourage him. There he was again. And he had another life for the next 7 years before he died in 92 as a very well thought of singer and composer, and He sang at the Vancouver, BC Folk Festival, where thousands of people come. He sang with Pete Seeger a number of different places. People would invite him to folk festivals and so forth.
During that time after he moved to California, did he kind of leave the labor movement behind and leave music behind?
He was in a union when he was in San Diego, the Carpenters Union, so he never left unions completely, but he didn't make very much money as a carpenter. He mostly did it kind of through entrepreneurial means. I don't know what he did with singing during that time period. I know that after he sort of retired from working all the time, and maybe that's when the music came back. And then also he discovered that the Southern Tenant Farmers Union was having a reunion in 1982. And the leader of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, H.L. Mitchell, had published a book called Mean Things Happening in This Land. That's John's song. There are mean things happening in this land, but the union's going on, and the union's going strong. There are mean things happening in this land. And so that was a book, and he discovered it in a bookstore. And he said, oh my gosh, you know, H.L. Mitchell's still alive, and so he contacted them. And that's how eventually he got reconnected to things.
One thing I found delightful in listening to some of the music that you have is a song that he did much later, and he refers to President Reagan busting the Air Traffic Controllers Union. Tell me about that song.
Yeah, that's an interesting song. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. We don't want Reagan anymore. That's to the tune of, oh, death, oh, death, oh, death. Death, please stay your hand a while. It's an old song used by whites and blacks. How appropriate, you know, because Reagan was killing the labor movement, and the song then goes on to tell what Reagan was doing to the labor movement and why we don't want him anymore. So he started writing again, essentially, in the 1980s.
What do you think is most amazing about John Hancock?
Well, one thing is that he survived and returned. A lot of people who went through that time period didn't make it. And he was sort of creative enough, I guess, and had enough skills, partly because he had some literacy and could write and could do math, that people couldn't cheat him as easily as they could somebody who was totally illiterate. So he would check the books to see whether when he brought cotton in to get his share of the cotton, whether they were cheating him or not. And of course, you weren't supposed to do that, and that's one of the reasons he got run out of Arkansas, was because he was always questioning everything. But he had these skills and kind of a very optimistic view of life, which is surprising given, you know, the way he grew up in that part of the country. He really believed that some of the poems he sent me at the end of his life are really moving. They're written toward young people, basically saying, you can do anything you set your mind to do. And he never lost that optimism. And it's surprising that he ever had the optimism in the first place.
Michael Honey is the author of The Sharecropper's Troubadour, John L. Hancock's The Southern Tenant Farmers Union and the African American Song Tradition. He's the Fred and Dorothy Haley Endowed Professor of the Humanities at the University of Washington, Tacoma. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Great. I just need to record a little bit of room silence.